Kansas native Ben Lerner, who was first applauded for his three poetry books and is now the poetry editor of Harper's Magazine, has lately focused on writing fiction. In 2017, the British publication Granta included him in their once-a-decade list of the best young American novelists to watch. In 2020, his third novel, The Topeka School, published in fall 2019, won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and was a finalist for both the Pulitzer and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Set in the late 1990s, it has several parallels to his own Topeka High School days in the Kansas Capitol, where he was a national debate champion and both his parents worked as psychologists at the world-renowned Menninger Clinic before the operation moved to Houston. Though inspired by real life, Lerner reveals his approach to writing novels.
Fiction is the permission to shape biographical material into a more compelling aesthetic object, and I'll always sacrifice biographical truth for the sake of the artwork.
Ben Lerner shares more about his fiction and his poetry in an upcoming episode of New Letters on the Air that features our conversation right after the October 2019 release of his novel, The Topeka School. Today, you'll get to hear his first public reading from the book that preceded my interview at the Kansas City Public Library. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air, and before we settle in for that long reading by Ben Lerner, here's the introduction at the library by fellow fiction writer Christy Hodgen, who teaches creative writing at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and in March 2020 became the editor of New Letters magazine.
Many thanks to the library for hosting us this evening. We really couldn't ask for better partners than the Kansas City Public Library. You share our interest in bringing people together to discuss writing and art and current events. I too want to thank the English department at UMKC for helping to bring this event together. And as always, we're especially grateful for our sponsors, the board of the Carolyn Benton Cockafer Chair in Continuing Education. They too sponsor so many events throughout the year, readings and lectures and conversations that enrich so many people's lives. It's an honor to introduce Ben Lerner, poet, novelist, essayist, and critic. His books of poetry include The Lichtenberg Figures, Angle of Yaw, and Mean Free Path. His novels are Leaving the Atocha Station, published in 2011, 1004, published in 2015, and the just-released The Topeka School, from which he'll be reading this evening. His long essay on the hatred of poetry was published in 2016. Ben's work has won all the awards, the Guggenheim, the Fulbright, you name it, and garnered praise from every critic and venue you can possibly imagine, even the tough ones, the notoriously cranky ones. His books have been noted as among the best books of the year by The New Yorker, The New York Times Book Review, The Wall Street Journal, The Village Voice, The Boston Globe, NPR, Vanity Fair, The Guardian, etc. There's a list and it goes on for a while. The critics, they just have to give it up. They seem to have come to a rare consensus that this work that Ben Lerner does is something new. Unlike anything else I've read before is a popular refrain in his reviews. Words like sui generis are thrown around. And yes, lest I forget to mention the MacArthur he won in 2015, words like genius. This is, I'm happy to say, one of those cases where the hype holds up. In fact, it's not quite enough. Ben Lerner is an electrifying writer. When I first discovered Leaving the Atocha Station, maybe 5 years ago, it was one of those deals where I couldn't put the book down. I was reading with one hand while absentmindedly stirring a pot of macaroni and cheese together with the other for my kids. He's one of those hold my calls, I'm reading types of writers. You stay up late to finish a book, and given the state of our lives right now, which is frenzied often, I think, that's saying something. That's a rare thing. I suppose my favorite thing about reading Ben's writing is the curious mix of the ordinary and extraordinary he brings to the page. Often the characters and situations are, for lack of a better word, ordinary or not so unusual, I suppose, is nearer to what I mean. But then something extraordinary happens. Sometimes the extraordinary thing comes in the form of an event, an unexpected plot twist, or sometimes it's the form of the book, the complexity of the structure, of the narrative itself, and all the questions that generates. But often, always, actually. The extraordinary thing is also to be found in the energy and erudition of the writing, the sentences themselves. Ordinary people and situations are so closely observed and carefully described in Ben's work. You read Ben's work and you put the book down and go about your day, but for a while, walking around, you're seeing the world new again. Even small details take on a new importance. I can think of no better thing for a book or writer to do, and that's why I feel so fortunate that he's agreed to read for us tonight. Please welcome Ben Lerner.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. Thank you, Christy, for the lovely introduction and for all the thoughtfulness in making the visit possible and for everyone at UMKC and at the library. One of the things that for me made the book feel writable is that I felt like I grew up in between two very different regimes of talk. You know, like the Menninger Clinic, psychologists generally, my psychologist parents, like those are institutions that run on talk and privilege expressivity of one form or another, right? I mean, that's the idea. But I felt like generally, and this is reductive, I mean, there are all kinds of exceptions to this, right? But that generally, in the kind of image of masculinity beyond, like outside of that culture, that wasn't part of that culture, was a culture in which to talk, unless you were talking trash, if you were a man, to express emotional vulnerability, for example, would be considered a sign of weakness. I heard this story, I don't know if it's true, that when you would train at Menninger's and you were gonna give Rorschach tests to like farmers, they had to say to everybody, like, look, like the farmers are always gonna score in the psychotic range. Not because they're psychotic, but because they're just not gonna guess. Like you can show them like the ink blot and say, what do you see? And they're not gonna participate. They're gonna like fold their arms. And I respect that, by the way. I mean, I think folding your arms in front of a lot of psychological testing is probably a really good idea. So in the book, Adam's challenge or his kind of weird compromise is to try to figure out a way to bring his verbal upbringing into this other world in a way in which he can still be cool and pass in a certain way as a tough guy. And that means he becomes a kind of verbal bully, basically. So it's not a good solution. But for Adam, certainly, the challenge is, if I can't fight, right, and I want to a certain degree preserve the values of the household culture, but I also want to be like a cool kid in this tough milieu, what am I going to do? And to a certain degree, that leads him to kind of weaponize his debate skills, which is something that he has to then unlearn. The issue is not that men don't talk. Men talk on and on and on and on, right? But it's that they don't listen. And the book hopes to kind of be, you know, a work of literature is a work of listening and not just a felt silence. So that's all there. Part of why Topeka seemed interesting to me is because of these two very different relationships that I'm exaggerating to make legible, being between these two different regimes of talk.
Ben Lerner at the Kansas City Public Library in fall 2019 with his then new book, The Topeka School, a specifically American coming-of-age story for the character Adam Gordon, who, by the way, was featured as an adult in Lerner's first novel, Leaving the Atosha Station. Now on New Letters on the Air is the promised reading by Ben Lerner, who explores language, masculinity, and relationships in his third novel, The Topeka School.
Since this is the first chance I've had to read from the finished book, I'm just going to read from the opening scene. They were drifting on her stepfather's boat in the middle of an otherwise empty man-made lake encircled by large tract houses. It was early autumn and they were drinking southern comfort from the bottle. Adam was in the front of the boat watching a changeable blue light across the water that was probably a television seen through a window or glass door. He heard the scrape of her lighter, then saw smoke float over him, unravel. For a long time, he had been speaking. When he turned to see what effect his speech had had, she was gone, jeans and sweater and a little pile with the pipe and lighter. He said her name, suddenly aware of the surrounding quiet, and put his hand in the water, which was cold. Unthinkingly, he lifted her white sweater and smelled the wood smoke from earlier that evening at Clinton Lake, the synthetic lavender of what he knew to be her shower gel. He said her name again, louder now, then looked around. A few birds skimmed the undisturbed surface of the lake. No, those were bats. When did she dive or step off the boat, and how could she have made no splash, and what if she was drowned? He yelled now. A dog responded in the distance. From spinning around in search of her, he felt dizzy and sat down. Then he stood again and looked along the edges of the boat. Maybe she was just beside it, stifling her laughter, but she wasn't. He would have to pilot the boat back to the dock where she must be waiting. There was a dock for every two or three subdivisions. He thought he saw a firefly signal slowly from the shore, but it was too late in the year for that. He felt a wave of anger rising, and he welcomed it, wanted it to overwhelm his panic. He hoped Amber had dived into the water before his rambling confession of feeling. He'd said they'd stay together once he left Topeka for school, but now he knew they wouldn't. He was eager to demonstrate his indifference as soon as he found her safe on land. See the outboard motor gleaming in the moonlight. For any of his friends, managing the boat would be easy. All of them, even the other Foundation kids, exhibited a basic Midwestern mechanical competence, could change their oil or clean a gun, whereas he couldn't even drive stick. He located what he assumed was a starter rope, pulled it, nothing happened. He pushed what must have been the throttle to another position and tried again, nothing. He was beginning to wonder if he might have to swim. He wasn't sure how well he swam when he saw the key in the ignition. He turned it and the engine started up. As slowly as possible, he motored back to shore. When he approached the land, he turned the engine off but failed to bring the boat in parallel with the dock. A loud crack when the fiberglass hit the wood, which silenced the nearby bullfrogs. Nothing seemed damaged, not that he really looked. He rushed to throw the lines gathered in the boat around the cleats nailed to the dock, quickly improvised some knots, then pulled himself out of the boat. He prayed that no one was watching him from a window. Without taking the keys or her clothes or pipe or bottle, he sprinted up the incline through the wet grass toward her house. If the boat drifted back out on the water, that would be her fault. The large glass doors facing the lake were always unlocked. He slid one open quietly and went in. Only now did he feel the cold sweat. He could make out her brother's shape on the couch, pillow over his head, sleeping in the glow of the large television. The news was on mute. The room was otherwise dark. He thought of waking him, but instead removed his Timberland boots, which he assumed were muddy, and crept across the room to the white carpeted stairs. He went up slowly. He'd stayed over two or three times before, when she'd told her parents he'd had too much to drink. They thought he'd slept in the guest room. They'd thought correctly that he'd called home. But the prospect of encountering anyone now, when he hadn't even confirmed that she was present, horrified him. Her mom took sleeping pills. He'd seen the oversized prescription bottle, knew she mixed them nightly with her wine. Her stepdad had slept through a brawl at a recent party. They'll never wake up, he reassured himself. Just don't knock anything over. He was glad to be in his socks. He reached the first floor and surveyed the dark, expansive living room before he climbed the next flight of stairs to where the bedrooms were. He could almost make out the large, generic hunting scene on the far wall, dogs flushing game from the woods beside a lake at sunset. He could see the red light blinking on the panel for the alarm system they thankfully never armed, and a little light collected around the silver edges of the framed family photographs on the mantel, teenagers in sweaters posing on a leaf-strewn lawn, her brother holding a football. Something ticked and settled in the giant kitchen. He went upstairs. Hers was the first open door on the right, and without turning on the light, he could see from the doorway that Amber was in her bed, under the covers, breathing steadily. His shoulders relaxed. The relief was profound, and the relief made more room for anger. It also let him realize how badly he had to piss. He turned and crossed the hall into the bathroom and carefully shut the door, and without turning on the light, lifted the lid. On second thought, he lowered the seat again and sat down. A car passed slowly outside, its headlights illuminating the bathroom through an open Venetian blind. It wasn't her bathroom. The electric toothbrush, the hair dryer, these particular soaps, these were not her toiletries. For an instant, he thought, desperately hoped, that they might belong to her mother, but there were too many other discrepancies. The shower door was different, its glass frosted. Now he smelled the lemon-scented gel beads in a jar atop the toilet. Alien dried flowers hung from a purple sachet on the wall, and a single shudder of retrospection, his impressions of the house were changed. Where was the piano that nobody played? Wouldn't he have seen the electric chandelier? The carpet on the stairs, wasn't the pile too thick, too dark in the dark to have been truly white?
You're listening to Ben Lerner read from the opening of his novel, The Topeka School, depicting the high school senior Adam Gordon in the 1990s. This is New Letters on the Air.
Along with the sheer terror of finding himself in the wrong house, with his recognition of its difference, was a sense, because of the house's sameness, that he was in all the houses around the lake at once, the sublime of identical layouts. In each house, she or someone like her was in her bed, sleeping or pretending to sleep. Legal guardians were farther down the hall, large men snoring. The faces and poses in the family photographs on the mantel might change, but would all belong to the same grammar of faces and poses. The elements of the painted scenes might vary, but not the level of familiarity and flatness. If you opened any of the giant stainless steel refrigerators or surveyed the faux marble islands, you would encounter matching modular products in slightly different configurations. He was in all the houses, but precisely because he was no longer bound to a discrete body, he could also float above them. It was like looking at the miniature train set Klaus, his dad's friend, had given him as a child. He didn't care about the trains, could barely make them run, but he loved the scenery, the green static flocking spread over the board, the tiny yet towering pines and hardwoods. When he looked at the impossibly detailed trees, he occupied two vantages at once. He pictured himself beneath their branches and also considered them from above. He was looking up at himself, looking down. Then he could toggle rapidly between these perspectives, these scales, and a relay that unfixed him from his body. Now he was frozen in fear in this particular bathroom and in all the bathrooms simultaneously. He looked down from 100 windows at the little boat on the placid man-made lake. Touches of white paint atop the dried acrylic surface add a sense of motion and of moonlight. He swam back into himself. He felt like a timer has started somewhere, that he had minutes, maybe only seconds, to flee the house into which he'd unintentionally broken before someone emptied a shotgun into his face or the cops arrived to find him hovering outside the bedroom of a sleeping girl. Fear made it difficult to breathe, but he told himself that he would press rewind, quietly walk back out the way he'd come, disturbing no one. That's what he did, although now the little differences called out to him as he descended. There was a large L-shaped couch he hadn't seen before. He could tell the coffee table here was glass and not dark wood like hers. At the bottom of the stairs, he hesitated. The front door was right there, beckoning. He'd be free. But his Timberlands were downstairs where he'd left them. To recover them, he'd have to pass the sleeping stranger. Despite his fear that he might at any moment be discovered, he decided he must go after his boots, less because they were evidence, could be traced to him, than because he felt that he'd be risking ridicule, humiliation, if he returned to her barefoot. He could intuit the shape of the story, could sense that it would spread, how she'd left him first to mishandle the boat and then to lose his footwear in the midst of whatever misadventure. Hey, Gordon, you got your shoes tied on? Got your slippers? A memory from middle school of Sean McCabe coming home in socks, in tears, after he'd been jumped for his Air Jordans flared up before him. Sean still got shit about it, and Sean could bench 300 pounds. The young man who had been her brother had turned his face toward the back of the couch. The pillow had fallen to the floor. The giant head of Bob Dole moved its lips on the screen as he crept past. He picked up his boots and slowly slid open the door. The rollers jammed a little. He had to apply some force, causing a loud squeak. The body on the couch stirred and started to sit up. All over Lake Sherwood housing community, the body stirred and started to sit up. Without closing the door, he bolted, boots in hand, over the wet grass, indifferent to uneven ground, sticks and stones, at a speed he might never match again, his body grateful for something to do with its adrenaline. No one yelled after him. There was only his footfall, blood thundering in his ears. He triggered a few motion lights and so moved closer to the water. He ran at full force for a minute before he realized he wasn't sure where he was going. He dropped to a knee, lungs burning, looked behind him to make sure he wasn't being followed. He pulled his boots on over his wet socks. Then he got up and sprinted between two houses until he reached the street. His only goal now was to find his red 89 Camry parked in her driveway and go home, to bed. He was still scared. At any moment, he might hear sirens. But away from the water and the scene of his ridiculous trespass, he felt the worst was over. He patted his pocket to confirm the presence of his keys and walked quickly along the curb. There were no sidewalks. But he did not run so as to minimize suspicion on the off chance he was seen. He walked and walked, ashamed to be on foot. He could not find his car, her house. He must have pointed the boat in exactly the wrong direction. After he'd searched for almost half an hour, had circled half the lake, he saw, was overjoyed to see his car where he had parked it some hours before. The sound of the doors unlocking was deeply reassuring. He got in, found his pack of Marlboro Reds on the passenger seat and shook one loose. He turned the key to the on position, but did not start the engine. He lowered his window and lit his cigarette with a yellow Bic he took from the cup holder and inhaled what felt like his first full breath since he discovered her absence on the boat.
We're about to conclude Ben Lerner's reading from the beginning of his novel, The Topeka School, but need to alert you, there are several bleeps to cover bad language ahead.
He started the engine and turned the headlights on to discover that she was standing, had been standing, in the threshold of her front door wearing an oversized sweater. Her almost waist-length dark blonde hair was down. He cut the engine reflexively, turning off the lights. Barefoot, she walked to the car and opened the passenger door and got in. She helped herself to a cigarette, lit it, and said, as though he were a few minutes late for an appointment, "Where have you been?" He was furious. He could not admit that he'd been scared, couldn't say he'd been unequal to managing the boat or that he'd almost confronted the wrong young woman in another house. He demanded an explanation. "What the f*** is wrong with you?" "I wanted to swim," she said, and shrugged and smoked when he pressed, tobacco mixing with the smell of her conditioner. Absently, she began playing with his hair. "My stepdad used to give these, like, endless speeches at dinner. Now he barely talks, and anyway, we don't eat together. I think he's depressed, like he should have a therapist see your parents at the foundation. It's weird now that he's quiet because before he would make dinners into these long discussions, except not really because nobody discussed anything, he just talked in our direction. He'd ask my brother a question every once in a while, but it was always like pop quiz. What did I say made this a hard time for the aeronautics business? You know, he got rich off somebody else's invention, some kind of screw that doesn't weigh anything. And my brother would never have to answer because my stepdad answered his own questions, and the answer was always China, basically. Then there was this one night last summer when my mom was letting me sneak white wine and my brother was out, and I had to be the one at the table getting talked at, and it was getting on my nerves for real. Maybe it was because I was a little f***ed up or because I'm just older now and so, like, more aware of my mom, what she's been through, starting with my dad. But anyway, I did this stupid, also kind of awesome thing. Really, really slowly, I started lowering myself in my chair, like sliding down out of it while he was eating his ravioli, talking about whatever. My mom was already in the kitchen loading the dishwasher. She never eats. It requires a lot of core strength going down so slowly. all those crunches, all that crystal joking. At dance, they are always telling me to visualize a movement as I do it, and I was visualizing myself as a liquid flowing down the chair, all the way down off my chair until I was literally under the table and my stepdad still hadn't noticed anything and my mom was in there cleaning and I was trying not to laugh. Or maybe cry, Adam asked, and she looked at him. At how f***ing sad this dude is, maybe. Or yeah, like for my mom who's married to him. Like he doesn't realize the audience has gone home while he's just going on and on. And then I seal crawl so slowly under the table across the carpet, holding my breath into the kitchen. My mom has stopped cleaning, and now she's on the other side of the island and doesn't see me, and I stand up really quietly. She's holding her pink wine, looking out the window at the lake or more at her reflection in the glass because it's night. I get the bottle from the fridge door and pour most of it into a plastic cup and come up to her with my, like, big gulp, and she's coming back from Mars and about to say something to me, but I shush her with a finger on my lips and whisper, listen. We can hear my stepdad in the dining room telling nobody about Ross Perot. He was obsessed with Ross Perot in China. And my mom maybe doesn't understand what's going on yet, but we tiptoe over to the doorway and stand there looking into the dining room while he talks to the air like AM radio, and wine is almost coming out of my nose. We stand there forever before he looks up, like we caught him beating off. He looks at my chair, then back at us, and now me and my mom and I start really cracking up. And then he gets this f***ed up smile that's pure rage. Like, how dare you bitches laugh at me? But I give him the stepdaughter's smile back and hold it. We basically have a staring contest, and my mom's laughter gets all nervous until finally his face relaxes and it's all a big joke. It would take Adam 20 years to grasp the analogy between her slipping from the chair and from the boat. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Ben Lerner, reading from his third novel, The Topeka School, at the Kansas City Public Library in October 2019, when he was UMKC's Kaka Fair Chair Writer-in-Residence. His book had just been released and has since won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and was a finalist for both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award, and was named a Top 10 Book of the Year by the New York Times. In an upcoming interview that I did with him right after this reading on stage, he talks about his approach to writing both fiction and poetry.
I hope that I get to write some poems next, but I don't feel like I'm in control of it. Like, I don't get to decide in advance what's writable. I just have to kind of discover it as I go. It's like the best and worst thing about writing. In fact, it sometimes seems like the only way to guarantee that I won't be able to write a poem is to sit down and intend to write one.
Listen next time to hear the title poem from Ben Lerner's third poetry book, No Art. You'll also hear more from his novel, The Topeka School, and he talks about the large number of fellow poets who have come out of the capital city of Kansas. If you feel like you can't wait to hear more of Ben Lerner, visit our audio archive to listen to a 2007 interview about his first two poetry books, which we ran again after he was named a MacArthur Fellow in 2015. That's on our website, newletters.org. There you can hear the latest classic programs we've been rebroadcasting as we try to find our way through the budget cuts in these pandemic times. From New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council State Agency, today's show has music by composer Kevin MacLeod from his site incompetech.com, which has enhanced this and most of our weekly programs. Originally produced with Anna Stokes, Evan Lohman, Henry Shee, and assistant producer Jamie Walsh, I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.